Now, the last two lectures were about the new man of the Enlightenment, the one who was to emerge from the broken monopoly of the church, who was to be rational, whose education was to be like Emile's, the genuine, the natural, the state of man before modern civilization had gone wrong and had corrupted him. For modern civilization, of course, read Christianity. Nevertheless, this emphasis on reason, the kind of education that Professor Fishman talked to you about last time, did mean a search for authority. Both the idea of reason and Rousseau's idea of nature were based on a presupposition, the presupposition of a harmonious universe. And this presupposition of a harmonious universe meant necessarily a recourse to authority, because there had to be some authority to make the universe harmonious, to hold it together so that people could make sense out of it. We talked about the natural laws, and Rousseau believed in the natural laws as well. They functioned as well, remember, in Emile's education. But now we must come today to the second authority. One is nature and reason, based on the natural laws, based in the last resort upon God, a kind of deism that I talked about and Mr. Fishman talked about as well. But the second authority was not God, but the classics. Now, the classics in a peculiar way. For to be sure, the classics were rediscovered in the 18th century, but not classical literature. Classical literature had already gone through an amazing renaissance in the 17th century, in 17th century France. But what was rediscovered was classical art and the meaning of classical art. And when I say classical art, it means classic as a totality of life in a century that was, as I've told you before, a quest for totality. Not merely classics as drama, as it was in the 17th century very largely, but the classics as a totality, the classics as a principle of beauty, as an example of the critical mind in action before Christianity corrupted it. In other words, the rediscovery of the classics coincided with the search for a tradition other than the Christian tradition. And the only tradition other than the Christian tradition to which people could come was the classical tradition, clearly enough. And it is therefore the classical tradition which becomes of great importance. Moreover, they found support for their anti-Christian attitude in the classics. They were especially fascinated by episodes like Socrates' death. For in Socrates' death, they saw the risk of a critical mind, a rational and critical mind. They were fascinated by the Greek quest for self-knowledge, for the self-knowledge of man, for the knowledge of nature, for the idea of man in nature, which was so important for them, the Greek quest of self-knowledge, of a critical mind. But above all, they saw in the Greek tradition exemplified both the critical mind and a principle of order. And that was, of course, the clue to everything we have said, the critical mind and a principle of order. They saw it exemplified now, not in God, but in a tradition, in the Greek tradition. the critical mind of Socrates, the principle of order in the love for beauty as harmony and proportion, in the symmetry of the Greek temples and the Greek statues, to which I will return in a moment. So that what was important was the combination of beauty and order. And that indeed becomes the slogan of the century. You can see it in another way in the 18th century garden. You may have been to Versailles, the gardens of Versailles. Any kind of 18th century garden illustrates in another way the principle of beauty and order. The new architectural device of the 18th century, which in England is called the folly. Why is it called the folly? Because, again, it was a principle of a critical mind and order, that you could not have perspective without ending the perspective. And so in all 18th century landscaping, in the gardens of Versailles, noticeably also in the Viennese Palace of Schönbrunn, in the end of the vast vistas, sort of the critical mind, the infinite, the vast vistas, are never really vast. At the end is the replica of a medieval ruin, as in Schönbrunn and in Versailles, or a fountain, or something, a folly, as it's called in England, to end the vista, because infinity must always be contained. And so you can see, if you like, in the layout of the famous 18th century gardens, 18th century landscape, as I say, Versailles or Schönbrunn in Vienna, or any English country house, they're all 18th century. You can see with the vast vistas, the orderly gardens, always an end to the vista, the containment. A fountain, a statue, more often a replica of a medieval castle or of some kind of pleasure palace taken from China, because the Chinese revival, I'll come back to that in another connection, was also important. But something folly, and it was called a folly because it had no object. These can be, as in Schönbrunn in Vienna, the Austrian Emperor's palace, these can be palaces with nothing inside, just facades. That's why they are called follies. They are just facades. Now, you have the same thing in Greece, in Greek ideas, the combination of beauty and order to make it conform for beauty and order. For the classics were now subsumed under what we might call the cult of beauty rather than literature, and especially the rediscovery of sculpture and art. Greek sculpture had vanished from Western civilization for nearly two centuries and was rediscovered almost by accident, if you like, by some people of sensibility in the middle of the 18th century, above all by a German who worked at the court of Saxony, J.J. Winckelmann. But there are two things which coincided to stimulate the imagination. The rediscovery around 1750 by Winckelmann in the castle of the King of Saxony, of Greek statuary. But above all, the rediscovery in Rome, by an accident, underground, of the most famous and symbolic statue for the age, the statue of Laocoon. That is to say, the famous statue of Laocoon and his sons, strangled by snakes, which was discovered by accident in 1767. Now, these two things, the discovery of Greek sculpture in Saxony and then popularized by Winckelmann in his most famous book, His History of Ancient Art, and the discovery of the Laocoon group, both in 1767, to give you a firm date, sparked an enthusiasm the length and breadth of Europe among the intellectuals, like the rediscovery of a kind of new civilization, of an ancestry which we did not think we possessed, going back beyond Christianity to a combination of beauty and order. What it meant was best symbolized by a famous book, by the book by the German poet and dramatist Friedrich Schiller, called The Aesthetic Education of Man of 1795. And Friedrich Schiller's Aesthetic Education of Man of 1795 can give you an idea. What they found in this new rediscovery of Greek sculpture. As Schiller puts it, the political problems follow the path of aesthetics, since it is through beauty that we arrive at freedom. So that at the beginning there is the link of beauty and freedom. We can only have freedom through the contemplation of beauty, and it is only through beauty that we arrive at freedom. Therefore, aesthetics and aesthetic taste, by which he meant Greek taste, aesthetic taste must stand at the beginning of any fight for freedom. For the immortal examples of Greek art can lead to the regeneration of man, an end to his fragmentation. And here you can see why. It is a matter of individual regeneration, which had been so botched by Christianity. The individual regeneration through totality. Greek art was a totality. Greek sculptures, the Laocoon group, I'll come back to it, was both a political statement, an aesthetic statement, a statement of the totality of human endeavor. For as Schiller put it, beauty arises from the enduring, man's person, and not the changing man's condition. In other words, Greek sculpture rises above man's condition to the enduring, the eternal. It puts up a rival eternity to Christianity, an eternity not of corruption, but of beauty. It rises above man's condition to eternity. It reaches out again. It reaches out, as you can see, to an eternal idea. And why does it do so? For Greek art is utter rest. It's utter rest. It is, as Schiller puts it, a closed creation. It is self-contained. It is, and I'll come back to that in a minute, restful, self-contained, analogous to men. The autonomy of man and the autonomy of beauty. The self-contained beauty of Greek art and the autonomy of man. The wholeness of humanity. But the clue to it, in a way, is something else, Schiller says. And that brings us back again to our main theme. It brings us back to the natural law, and it brings us back to Emile's education. For what Schiller says is the inevitable effect of the beautiful is freedom from passion. That to say again, beauty controls passion. Only the communication of the beautiful unites society. Every being forgets its limitation in the enchantment. But the enchantment of beauty also restrains the passions, for beauty is order. What this means, we shall see still more if we turn from Schiller's Aesthetic Education of Man to Winckelmann's great book, The History of Ancient Art, which was influential everywhere. Diderot in France accepted it, Herder in Germany. And it is partly so popular because it was written in pithy phrases. I shall cite some of you. Phrases which became really, they went into the language. They became part of the general language. And it is partly because of the pithy phrases which became part of the general language that Winckelmann became so important. Winckelmann, whom Diderot called the man who summoned a submerged continent to the surface of our century. And that is about how it was regarded, to summon an emerged continent to the surface of our century. The idea of Winckelmann is clear. First were the classics, then everything in decline. But what sort of beauty? The beauty of proportion, of symmetry. The whole sculpture. One of Winckelmann's main ideas, which will be very important, is that beauty must be total. You must grasp the total picture. It's not just the nose, the eyes. Beauty is the total picture of the face. It is a totality, the total picture of beauty. Moreover, beauty is always passive. Beauty is always, as it were, without a passion. For the most famous phrase of Winckelmann, which you will find repeated the length and breadth of Europe, is the following. As the depth of the sea always remains calm, however much the surface may be agitated, so does the expression in the figures of the Greeks reveal a great and composed soul in the midst of passion. So that's it. That's it. That's the concept of beauty, which, of course, meshes with the age. As the depth of the sea always remains calm, however much the surface may be agitated, so does the expression in the figures of the Greeks reveal a great and composed soul in the midst of a passion. For Winckelmann, then, the only path for us to recapture greatness is the imitation of the ancients. And that's, of course, true, as the 19th century will be the century of the imitation of the ancients, from the 18th century to the Wisconsin capital. It is all based on this idea, to the national stereotype, on this. And the result is a kind of idealization. Those who know and imitate Greek works of art find in these masterpieces not alone beautiful nature, but more than nature, something beyond nature, an ideal beauty, an ideal beauty, as Plato describes it. Beauty, which, as Plato says, is only in the mind, is now expressed in art. In other words, what you get here is the ideal type, which will be so important. Beauty as ideal type. Beauty has to be an ideal type because it must be gathered whole and at once, and no part of the body, no part may be taken in isolation. Therefore, beauty is the ideal type, the ideal nature, or, if you like, the ideal man. As he puts it again in his History of Ancient Art, when he talks about Greek gymnastics, and the center, in a way, is gymnastics and Greek gymnastics. Through the gymnastics, the body became manly. And I shall come back to the concept of manly, which here has its origin. What we think is manly, what our civilization will think is masculine and manly, has here its origin. The body, through gymnastics, got its manly contours, which the Greeks gave to their sculpture without any superfluous flesh. The young Spartans, every 10 days had to undress naked in front of the ephors. And those young Spartan men, of course, who began to be fat, had to observe a strict diet. Yes, it was a law of Pythagoras that one had to be aware of all unessential fat or unessential flesh of the body. That is why the Greeks went in for wrestling. That is why during the wrestling and before the wrestling, all they were allowed to do is to drink milk. Alcibiades, for example, in his youth, refused to learn to blow the flute because blowing the flute would distort the face. Now, all of these ideas of Winckelmann became extremely important. A whole sense of beauty, the idea which you take for granted, but which comes from Winckelmann, the idea that to be beautiful is to be lithe, a lithe body, a male lithe body. That will not change. From Winckelmann to Hitler to today, the lithe body will be the ideal. So a lithe body, a muscular body, no fat, thinness, all of this is in a way the analogy from Greek culture. And you get therefore with it two things of great importance, an ideal of beauty, of male beauty, and an idea of masculinity, which is, as it were, symbolized by this idea of male beauty. The symbol of that beauty came to be Laocoon. And you can go through European literature, and I challenge you to find anybody of any quality who did not write an essay on Laocoon by 1800. Everybody wrote essays on Laocoon. Laocoon, that statue of a Greek father and his sons being strangled by snakes. Now, what was so remarkable about this statue, which you can see today in the Vatican Museum? What was so remarkable? And I want to read to you from the most typical of these essays, an essay by a man whose play you're reading, Lessing. Lessing's essay on Laocoon, the most typical and perhaps the most famous. And I read, "The general and distinguished characteristic of the Greek masterpiece of painting are noble simplicity and quiet grandeur." And that is the most famous thing of Winckelmann. That is the most famous thing. And everything else will now be contrasted. So that everything else will be contrasted to noble simplicity and quiet grandeur against a nervous age. I remember in my youth, when my parents said, "Leave your nervous Jewish hands alone, keep them quiet," they always said, "How far you're removed from this noble quiet and grandeur." I suppose that's right. But never mind. It became the antitype, the Jew, the black, whatever you have, the antitype for a German, the French, for a French, the German. The antitype is nervous, the nervous little Jew, the nervous hand. These became into the language. These became part of our language. Your nervous hands. You don't talk with your hands. That's bad. It's nervous. It is not what I would call the noble simplicity and quiet grandeur. And that again comes with the total beauty. Beauty is harmony and proportion in Greek sculpture. It is a totality. And it is again this search for order, for beauty and order, for the critical mind and order. And then he cites what I've cited already, "As the depths of the sea always remain calm, however much the surface may be agitated, so does the expression in the figures of the Greeks reveal a great and composed soul in the midst of passion. Such a soul is depicted in Laocoon's face, and not in his face, under the most violent suffering." Remember, he's being strangled by snakes. "The pain is revealed in every muscle and sinew of his body, and one can almost feel it oneself in the painful contraction of the abdomen without looking at the face or other parts of the body at all. However, this pain expresses itself without any sign of rage, either in his face or in his posture. He does not raise his voice in a terrible scream." That's That's what Laocoon is all about. And he ends his essay with the following. I wanted simply to establish that among the ancients, beauty was the supreme law of the arts. Once this has been established, it necessary follows that whatever else these arts may include must give way completely, if not compatible with beauty. And if compatible, it must be subordinated to it. Let us consider expression. There are passions and degrees of passions, which are expressed by the most hideous contortions of the face, and which throw the whole body into such a natural position as to lose all the beautiful contours of its natural state. The ancient artists either refrained from depicting such emotions or reduced them to a degree where it is possible to show them with a certain measure of beauty. Rage and despair did not degrade any of their works. I venture to say that they never depicted a fury. Wrath was reduced to seriousness. In poetry, it was the wrathful Jupiter who hurled the thunderbolt. In art, it was only the stern Jupiter. So what you have here is clear. You have here always the emphasis on this restraint against the Baroque. The Baroque now goes under, and I challenge you to read any guide to Rome till after the Second World War, where the Baroque of Rome is at all discussed. It's not even discussed, modern Rome, Baroque Rome, 17th century Rome, because from now on the Baroque is a nervous age. Kitsch, as we would say in German, bad. And so it goes under as against this kind of classicism. Hegel put it another way. Beauty must not be marred by accidents. And here again you have the quest for order, the quest for continuity in a non-Christian world. Beauty is the absence of accidents. Just as Newton appealed to God to correct the sunspots. In a way, Greek beauty takes the place of God. It is continuity, it is wholeness. It is, as Hegel put it, the absence of accidents. Thus will nations represent itself. Thus you have the education through beauty and the education, if you like, through order as well. Finally, in this idea of the classics, then, you have a combination. On the one hand, an outward manifestation. On the other hand, an inward condition. And you have something which already makes you see and realize a little bit that this will become an ever more visually oriented age, in spite of all the philosophy and the writings. Namely, that inward conditions must find outward expression, and that beauty is so important because it expresses the noblest in man. Because it expresses a noble man, not through nature, but through man himself. Now this, in a way, detachment of nature from the classics will be very important eventually, because eventually when we come to Romanticism, and I just want to say it here, nature will be made romantic, but man will always remain classic. That is to say, human beauty will never be assimilated to romantic nature. It will be kind of set within a romantic nature, but always as this classical formulation of beauty, of masculinity, and in the end, of the most masculine thing of all, the nation. So it's transposed from masculinity to the nation. So that you can have a romantic landscape and you can have a romanticism, but the modern nation represents itself by Greek temples, as you know, which comes, after all, to America as well. So the nation remains Greek, and Romanticism stands apart from the aesthetic education of man and from this idea of beauty. It implies, therefore, what a German writer called Carus entitled one of his books at the early 19th century, The Symbolism of the Human Form. And again, you are on the threshold, of course, of racist ideas, or they become integrated into racist ideas. In as much of fact as it will be very difficult to integrate, let us say, the blacks into the symbolism of the human form, and that eventually in the new science of anthropology, the excellence of a human skull will be judged by how close it comes to Greek skulls and Greek proportions. In other words, to put it in a context you already know, the golden chain of being will now be from the Greek god downwards to the animals. And the Negro will be closest to the ape because he is furthest removed from the Greek god. So that anthropological classification will be far from scientific. Far from scientific. It is far from scientific. It is actually classification on a principle of beauty. And the nearer you are to the beauty of Winckelmann's Greek sculpture, the nearer you are, as it were, in a way, to God. The nearer you have a soul, the less of a soul you have, the further you are away. So that this kind of meshes with a new golden chain of being, if you like, a new golden chain of being, not dependent on God, but on Greek beauty and Greek ideals of beauty. Indeed, eventually, whole cities will be rebuilt in the Greek style, and it will become a kind of enthusiasm, but it will last as well. The last authority to which I must address myself is history itself. Now, in a sense, that is already involved in this view and rediscovery of the classics. But the rejection of the myth of sacred history will lead to the founding in the 18th century of the science of history. And what do I mean by that? Up until the 18th century, there was no historical distance. It seems difficult for us to realize this. But history was immediate. Let me give you an example. When in the Renaissance, Machiavelli wrote about Rome, he thought that was yesterday. He had no idea that this was centuries ago. He thought you could telescope things. It's a quite different idea of time, and it has to do with the speed up of time as well, which I've mentioned so often, and the new concern of time. But as long as there was no real concern with time, history was telescoped. And until the 18th century, people thought if they were interested in Rome, the Romans were yesterday. They had no historical distance. And of course, Christ is today. That is to say, the sacred myth is today. You don't read up to now the Bible historically. You read the Bible immediately. And you believe that God today can talk to you from the burning bush. He can do that today. You don't read until the 18th century or later the Bible with historical distance. You do with the Bible what people did with the classics. It is immediate. It is immediate. Time is telescoped. So there had to be two things before you have historical distance, or rather three things. First of all, there had to be a speed up of time. Second of all, there had to be a denial of Christianity. The Christianity was superstition. You rejected the immediacy of Christianity. Religion has to be immediate. God has to be immediately present. Otherwise, religion doesn't make sense. It's clear. And thirdly, there had to be one other development, which I have no time, the development of perspective and the art of perspective from the Renaissance. But the art of perspective in the Renaissance, again, has to do with new ideas of time and new ideas of distance and time. But the art of perspective from the Renaissance, the new speed up of time and the rejection of sacred myths make for what we call historical distance, which becomes so important. There is therefore no longer a schematic relationship between past and present, a relationship that is immediate, and the present can enter, the past, I'm sorry, can enter your life at any moment. You can imitate the past immediately. And the interesting thing about the Greek discovery is that Winckelmann no longer believes that Greece was yesterday. He instead puts it as follows. He says, the modern age will perfect Greece. We will surpass Greece. We will be more beautiful than the Greeks. And that means already some historical perspective, that the Greeks are in the past. His term is the history of ancient art. It's the history of ancient art. Machiavelli never wrote a history in that sense. You can see this also quite clearly, I think, in Voltaire. And Voltaire, whom one might call, if you like, quite properly in a sense, the first historian. Because in Voltaire's history, his history of manner and morals and others, you have the same kind of perspective. A perspective, of course, which becomes, if I can put it that way, extremely famous. For Voltaire, after all, looks at the past as history. And he believes that history are, his most famous phrase, the follies of mankind. But that means, first of all, looking at the past already as history. These are the follies of mankind. And for Voltaire, history was an authority, but an authority that has to be overcome. For Winckelmann, it was an authority that has to be perfected. For Voltaire, it was an authority, if you like, that had to be, in one way or another, overcome this authority of history. For Voltaire, history was profoundly idealistic. He saw in history, in a way, the progress of reason. The progress of reason. And he saw history as the progress and obstacles to reason. If history was the folly of mankind, it is because it was Christianity and therefore the obstacle to reason. But he saw reason as a historical progress to be perfected in its own day. And here a fourth element comes in to the new sense of time, the elements of science, the element of the discoveries of science, the element of the discovery of science, which meant for a feeling of progress. Our century will leave nothing undiscovered. And this kind of idea of science, the discoveries of science, means, of course, or implies an idea of progress. History at first was used in a quite different way in science. History is used at first only as a description. If you open, let us say, a book in 1832, on the history of cholera or the history of disease, it won't be a history at all. It will be a description of disease. The word history has two meanings in English, the meaning we give it here and the meaning of description. So history in science is used at first and continues to be used as a description. But more and more, the word is also used in its modern ways as progress, as past and present. Now, the reason for that is progress in science, but there's another reason, namely the very bulk of discovery had to be organized somehow. And the very famous zoologist Lamarck in 1809 is the man who really does it. For Lamarck in 1809 tells us that somehow we have to organize all our remarkable discoveries, scientific discoveries in this century. We have to organize them somehow or other. And the only way to organize them is historically. The older discoveries, the newer discoveries. science, old science, and new science. So as a fourth element, we must add scientific progress. Scientific progress and the need to make sense out of the bulk of science, so that you have atavistic against modern, primitive against advanced. As I told you already, the idea eventually of a primitive mind and then an abstract mind. It's always progress, and you get very deeply ingrained the idea of primitivism as an earlier stage of history than the stage of advance, of an earlier stage of history than an advanced stage. And at the beginning, when Africa was rediscovered, there was no racism towards the blacks. The blacks were simply thought to be an earlier stage of history, and that eventually they can progress as Europe progressed. That will always remain in colonialism, by the way. Not all colonialism is racist. That's ridiculous and absurd and untrue. There's always the idea that the colonials, the blacks, are perhaps a more primitive stage, but there is hope for progress. It is only when the blacks become detached, as you will see later, from the idea of progress, that they become locked into position. But as long as there is the discovery of history, people are not locked into position. And it's very basic to Jewish emancipation, this idea of history. People are not locked into position. The black, the Jew in the ghetto, is atavistic, primitive. But once under the right condition, once his superstition has been eliminated, under the right condition, he too can join the parade of progress in the century. He too can, as it were, become a man of learning and reason, and even, in the Jew's case, certainly a person of beauty. Now, in all of this, then, history becomes, if you like, another organizing principle, another principle of order. Another organizing principle, a principle of order. And you must say that classics and history and the idea of God are all an integrative factor, if you like. They integrate the principle of order with the critical mind. They integrate, if you like, the frightening vistas of infinity with order. They are kind of follies, as in the landscape. They end the perspective. They give a feeling of security. They enable you to have reason and the critical mind without having chaos, because in a sense, again, the practice of reason depends on harmony. And a harmonious universe means a universe organized according to some eternal organizing principle. And the eternal organizing principle can be history, which is, as we say, a double-edged sword. It is something, a tradition, something to overcome, and something to organize by. Organized by past and present. Organized by progress, if you like. That is the classics, which organizes things in order and harmony, and again puts you into a tradition of beauty. And that is God, not the God, of course, of the burning bush, but the God of the natural laws. If you like, that is God manifested by nature, who again puts you into an ordered universe, this time not by past and present, but also eternally. Also an eternal force, also an eternal force. So the Greeks then are not with it, are not with us. They're very much with it, but they're not with us. It is our business to perfect their beauty. And that is what the 19th century, of course, thought it was doing in many ways, both in architecture, in art, and to a certain degree in politics as well. But not only do these authorities, as I call them, lead to an organizing principle, but beyond an organizing principle, these kind of eternities, if you like, provide a principle then of harmony, of present harmony, of present harmony, and above all, of totality. Because any longing for harmony is a longing for totality. In this particular way, the new was assimilated to the old. For example, this mind-blowing new encounter with Africa, this mind-blowing new encounter with the blacks, even when the Chinese turned up in Europe, which they did in the 18th century. These mind-blowing encounters, this was to the 18th century as if people from Mars came down today, we mustn't forget, was immediately integrated. Integrated not so much in the biblical story. You could integrate blacks into the biblical story, but integrated into this world of authority and harmony and natural law as the noble savage, as the man of progress. Yes, excuse me. Yes. Yeah. Yes, both. In Voltaire, it's both. Yeah. But history for Voltaire, history is for all of the men of the Enlightenment, really something that directs and contains and harmonizes their battle. History is always a battle of reason against superstition. Always. And thereby it becomes an organizing principle by the fact that it's not something unknown or infinite. History is, in a way, described and made known and made concrete, if you like, by this eternal battle of reason and superstition, which reason is winning. It's reason is winning it for Voltaire, though we shall come back to that never so simply. But reason is winning the battle, but it is always a battle, yes?
But is there a difference between trying to overcome history and trying to perfect it?
No. You perfect history by winning the battle. But in a sense, the battle is, in a way, an eternal battle. This is, of course, Marx. That's where Marx got it. Marx is unexplainable without the Enlightenment. History is a battle of light against darkness, and light is bound to triumph. In this, you must remember that from the 18th century on, people have loved simple explanation for history. Simple explanation of history. From Karl Marx to the present computer people. The simpler history is, the more security, the more follies you can build at the end of the vista, you see. So you mustn't forget that this is the beginning of history as an organizing principle and history as a security blanket. From Marx to social science history today. It's all the same thing. All right, next time I come to Nathan.